This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, episode 47 for New Year's Day, 2011. Hello and welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. In this first episode of our podcast for the new year 2011, we present a Public Relations Society of America Philadelphia chapter event. It's the presentation by Jeff Ansell, author of When the Headline is You, An Insider's Guide to Handling the News Media. We recorded Jeff's presentation at the PRSA Philadelphia chapter on November 11th, 2010 in Philadelphia. Former journalist Jeff Ansell's investigative reports have appeared on TV, radio, and in newspapers and magazines. Many of his investigations have resulted in things like the capture of Nazi war criminals, exposing doctors pushing drugs, and even led to the closure of a derelict nursing home. Following his career in journalism, Jeff served as senior vice president of Hill & Knowlton, a well-known global PR firm. Jeff is an associate of the MIT-Harvard Public Disputes Program, Dealing with an Angry Public, sponsored by Harvard Law School. Annually, he teaches Harvard Business School MBA students in the Negotiating Complex Deals and Disputes course. His consulting practice helps Fortune 500 companies create strategies to manage high-profile tough issues, including the Aaron Brockovich case. Jeff has counseled White House spokespeople and has shared the podium with former U.S. President George H.W. Bush, and more recently coached speakers at an event honoring President Bill Clinton.
Hello, everybody. Nice to meet you all, and I'm grateful for you taking the time to come out here. I know how busy you folks are, so for you to set this time aside is something that I'm very appreciative of. I've been a member of the PRSA for many years now, and in our time together today, I hope to offer a few thoughts that will ideally be of some degree of value for folks here. I want to offer a thought or two on the state of journalism today. I want to share with you why I think the model for media training is broken. And I'd like to offer up what I feel are five of the most important crisis tips to know when you're dealing with media in a bad news situation. And I want to also offer up a strategy for confronting bad news head on in a manner that reflects values that we claim to hold dear. And along the way, we might even play a game or two, if that's all right. And again, I'll do my best to answer questions, so feel free to ask them at any point along the way here today. By way of background, I am a media and crisis advisor. I do a lot of media training, and oftentimes I work in tough, high-profile, no-win situations. I've done a bit of work on the recent explosion, natural gas, San Bruno, California, that sadly killed six people. I've been on the Aaron Brockovich case in California for about 15 years now. I've had the opportunity to train White House spokespeople. Most recently, I finished a stint with the Vancouver Olympics, and of course, there was a terrible event that happened there just as the games were opening, a real tragedy. Linda mentioned as well the work I do with Dealing with an Angry Public. It's a course we offer, an executive course, twice a year at Harvard Law School. And I have the opportunity to also present and lecture annually in the Negotiation Dynamics course at Harvard Business School. But really, what brought me here today in my career generally is my background in media. I was a reporter for a number of years, TV, radio, magazines, newspapers, and I used to be a very aggressive reporter. And no kidding, folks actually used to run when they saw me coming. You know, when I used to go to work in the morning, my editor, my producer would say to me, well, Jeff, whose life are you going to ruin today? And oftentimes I felt about as popular as a pig at a bar mitzvah. But I got to tell you something. As aggressive as I wasn't prepared for what happened one day in the newsroom. Just as we were getting ready to go on the air, I was about to anchor the 6 o'clock news. We didn't really have a lead story that day. It was the summertime. It's historically quiet in the summer. And all we had to lead the news with was a stabbing. And I was always troubled by a major market station leading the news with a stabbing. Certainly as important as that is, I don't think it's lead material in a major market TV station. So then about 10 minutes to the hour, the assignment editor got on the loudspeaker. It was like a big gymnasium-style newsroom. He got on the loudspeaker and he announced to everybody, good news, we have a lead story, the stabbing victim died. And the newsroom erupted into a cheer. And that was the day I left journalism. And so what I decided to do was take what I've learned and put it to better use. And so that's how I segued into the career now, helping people tell their stories, deal with bad news, think on their feet, answer questions, and so on. And the work we do these days, it's changing. It used to be that mainstream media, of course, was driving a story, and more now it's social media moving stories forward, and this represents a revolutionary shift in how the news is produced and how the news is gathered and disseminated. Social media represents a game changer, because right now, news can be made by somebody who's sitting a block away in their basement in their sweatpants on their blog, creating a story that'll go viral in an instant. And the story doesn't even have to be true. You know, a long time ago, Mark Twain said, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes. And he said that before radio, TV, and the internet. And it's like Matt Drudge said, we're all newsmen now. But it saddens me to say that what we've all been bearing witness to is a dumbing down of the news. I mean, what's in the news these days? If you look at mainstream media, Paris Hilton says he's going to stop bullying people on his website. That's in the news. How did Bristol Palin perform on Dancing with the Stars last night? That's in the news. Keith Richard writes a book about Mick Jagger's private parts. That's in the news. Now, there's a whole bunch of reasons that we're experiencing this phenomena of dumbed down news. First of all, I think programmers are convinced that viewers, listeners, and readers do not want thoughtful public policy discourse. The belief being that people have shorter attention spans, they have little interest in matters of substance. And you couple that with the fact that in newsrooms everywhere, they're dealing with diminished resources. Reporters are working with less. And now we have reporters who, let's say, are working for the paper. They come back to the newsroom, they have to file a story for the web, they now make them schlep around a video camera so they can upload video, and their work is never done. They're doing research on the run, writing history in a hurry, and sometimes truth and perspective are going to become casualties. And so what often happens is reporters look for ways to tell a story in the easiest fashion possible. And I suppose when I was a reporter, I did this too. But I never realized it until I got out of the media and had the distance and had the opportunity to reflect on what it was I did for a living all those years. Because if you look at it, the easiest way to tell a story, a controversial story, if you're a journalist, is to cast characters. It's almost as if Steven Spielberg is sitting in the newsroom right now deciding who to cast for the 6 o'clock news tonight and tomorrow's paper. And who's the cast? Let's take a controversial story. Let's take BP, or anything current. We can apply it to any story that's controversial. The first character you need in a controversial story, and I'm not trivializing the terrible thing that happened, the first character you need is the victim. And of course, sadly, 11 fellas lost their lives on that rig. Of course, the environment was also a victim, and the folks who make their living in the Gulf, hampered as a result of the spill, they're also the victim. If you have a victim, it means you need to have a villain. So the villain is pretty self-evident, BP, of course. If you have a villain, it means you need to have a hero. So who's the hero in a BP story? Who do you think, folks? Pardon me? Could be the government, could be the media, could be special interest groups. Bobby Jindal, depending on your perspective. And then there's a character I call the witness, and they're the ones who saw the whole darn thing happen. And then you have a character that I call the expert. And when I was a journalist, more often than not, depending on the story, I used to ask my expert to put on a white coat if they had one because it made them look official. And it spoke louder than words. And then there's the character that the reporters always look for, and that's the character I call the village idiot. And the village idiot is the one who gums up everything for everybody. It's the one who says something real umday that they shouldn't say. And the risk is that oftentimes, the media, in their zeal to put a story together quickly, will cast both the villain and the village idiot in the same role. And if we look at a story about BP, who's the village idiot there? I want my life back. Which proves, by the way, that any one of our companies is one sentence away from disaster. Now, with regard to Tony Hayward, it's quite possible that he said a whole bunch of genuine and heartfelt statements that I'm sure he meant. But at the end of the day, you're only as good as your worst quote. And that's what's very important for us all to recognize. And it's so easy for even good news stories to turn out badly. When John Walter was named the CEO of AT&T, it was a proud day for the company. They had some troubles. Company was about to turn the corner. So he's having a news conference, and somebody in the audience says, Mr. Walter, who's your service provider? And he stood there and didn't know and didn't have a clue how to answer. And AT&T's market cap plummeted $4 billion directly after that. It is just too easy for thoughtful, intelligent, articulate people, especially, to say something dumb in the news. Sunrise Hospital, part of the Columbia Hospital System in New York, terrible thing happened there not too long ago. A homeless man walked into the emergency ward, and he went up to the person behind the counter and he said, "Ma'am, I need to see a doctor, please. I have a pain in my chest." And the woman said, "May I have your insurance, please?" "Ma'am, I haven't got any insurance." "Sir, we can't help you." "Please, I really don't feel well. I know that I smell and I know that I look dirty. Please, may I see a doctor?" "No, sir." So they had security walk the man out the front door, and what do you think happened 30 feet from the front door of the emergency? He dropped dead. And this is a man in his 30s. So Brian Ross of ABC News, who I think is one of the best investigative reporters around today, did a story on it. And he went to the PR person from Sunrise Hospital, and she's responding that, well, the patient was seen, which was baloney, he wasn't seen. And then he keeps asking her questions, and then she just bursts out, "Well, we're all going to die." So, like, again, you're only as good as your worst quote, and talk about, respectfully, a village idiot. And then look at the Prime Minister of Italy, Silvio Berlusconi. Remember when they had those terrible, terrible earthquakes in Italy and a lot of people were killed and made homeless? Do you remember what he said? He told the people, the survivors who lost their homes and lost family members, go to the beach. Treat it like a camping trip. Go take a vacation. And this guy is still running Italy. Now, Linda told you about the book when the headline is you. I did not write this book to bash the media. I still believe that to be a journalist is part of a noble calling. And for all the stuff that happened in the newsroom that day that I told you and all the stuff that I guess I'm not terribly proud of, there are a lot of things that I'm grateful I had the opportunity to do. I went undercover for a year posing as a drug addict, wired with a hidden microphone to expose doctors pushing drugs. I became their patient. Went to visit them every week for 12 months. Kept giving me all kinds of drugs. I'm grateful to say they're not doctors anymore. I spent a year chasing Nazi war criminals across North America. I hated every second of it because I wanted to kill these guys myself. I got one ship back to West Germany for trial. I investigated nursing homes where I live. I planted spies inside nursing homes. We got one home closed. We got amendments to the Nursing Home Act. So, you know, it's like Thomas Jefferson said, I'd rather have newspapers without government than government without newspapers. The problem, though, is that communicating with the news media represents a very unnatural dynamic. It goes against the grain for everyday conversation. I mean, knowing how to talk to reporters is almost like learning a new language. And even reporters don't know how to talk to reporters. A couple of years ago, I was given an assignment. Go to Washington and media train Carl Bernstein. You folks remember Carl Bernstein from Watergate? Well, I was terribly intimidated. I was about 17 years old at the time of Watergate, and as soon as I heard I have to go to Washington to media train Carl Bernstein, I panicked. I'm thinking, what can I share with Carl Bernstein? This is the world's greatest reporter. He brought down a president of the United States. And I got to tell you, as soon as I asked Carl the first question about his relationship with Bob Woodward, he put his foot in his mouth so deep it came out the other end. And I realized something really important that day. There is a skill, yes, involved in asking questions, but the real skill is in answering them. And even somebody like Carl Bernstein, who reported and wrote stories of such import, fell into the traps. So for those of us in this room who serve as spokespeople or who counsel and prepare spokespeople, it comes down to how we frame our stories and how we say what it is we say. Which reminds me of two seminary students who go to their priest. And one of the seminary students says, "Father, may I please smoke while I pray?" "No, my son, you may not." And the second seminary student says, "Father, may I please pray while I smoke?" "Yes, my son, you may." It is so important to frame information in just the right way. And that's why I became a media trainer, because it's not a level playing field. Like you, I'm sure you see, as I did and continue to do, see decent, innocent people who become media roadkill simply because they're not conversant with the process of how reporters gather the news, interpret the news, and report the news. And those of us in this room who act as spokespeople, we need to have the ability to ride shotgun over every word that leaves our lips, because it is too easy, and I say this especially if you're bright and articulate, to say something that makes you sound negative, defensive, and argumentative. Now, give me a show of hands, please. Who in this room would like to have the ability to think quickly on your feet when it comes to dealing with media? Raise your hand. Okay, I believed that too for 35 years. And then not too long ago, it hit me like a ton of bricks. That's the problem. We're thinking too quickly on our feet when we deal with media. Because when you think quickly on your feet, what it means is this: your mouth is here, your brain is here. What's next? What's next? Where am I going? And the space between the brain and the tongue is where we say, "I want my life back," or "they're all going to die." So you have to think on your feet. But thinking quickly on your feet is really, really not appropriate, because we need to see, as spokespeople, we need to see our words as like toothpaste. Once you squeeze it, it doesn't go back in. And we got to live with it. The problem is, human beings have a particular default when it comes to answering questions, especially in a confrontational situation. After interviewing thousands of people and after training thousands of people, I can tell you what the predictable response pattern is as soon as a tough question comes. As soon as that tough question comes, the first thing the respondent does is they hold their breath. The second thing they do is they stop listening. The third thing they do is they feverishly ask themselves, "How am I going to answer? How am I going to answer?" And then the fourth thing they do is they start to argue back. And the fifth thing they do is they have an out-of-body experience. And I think there's a better way. Now, traditionally, we've looked at media training as the answer. Media training will help guide us through the process. Folks, I believe the model for media training is broken. Media training emphasizes the imposition of a message. You know, we thought for the longest time that the answer, and media trainers reinforce this, that when you're dealing with reporters, just repeat your key messages over and over and over again. We thought that way the reporter won't be able to lay a glove on us. That'll give us some degree of influence over the way they edit the story. Well, the message's mantra doesn't work anymore, presuming it once did. Let me tell you a quick story about what happened in Toronto when the mayor of the city said something real, real inappropriate. And it was a story that got international coverage. The mayor's name was Mel Lastman. And he was on a world tour to convince the Olympic Committee to bring the Olympic Games to Toronto. So he goes to Asia, he goes to South America, he goes to Europe. He doesn't go to Africa. So the media say to him, "Mayor Lastman, you've toured the globe. Why haven't you gone to Africa?" So Lastman said, and I'm going to read his quote now, "What the hell, do I want to go to Mombasa? I'm sort of scared about going there. I just see myself in a pot of boiling water with all these natives dancing around me." Among other things, has seen too many Bing Crosby, Bob Hope movies. Well, people were outraged at that comment, justifiably. You know what, hit the fan big time. So Lastman held a news conference. And it was pretty clear that just before the news conference, his advisors were saying to him, "Well, Mayor Lastman, regardless of what the reporters ask, just come back and say, I'm sorry." So he said that to every question, even to questions that bore no resemblance. So the question was, "Mayor Lastman, how much damage have you done to the city?" "I'm sorry." "Mayor Lastman, will you now go to Africa?" "I'm sorry." "Mayor Lastman, do you think you should resign?" "I'm sorry." Now, when I was a reporter, and a spokesperson would repeat their message ad nauseum, What I would do is I would feature in my story my questions so they can hear how evasive this person is. Because a reporter not necessarily going to just use that one little soundbite. And each time a person repeats a message like that, it strips away a layer of sincerity and trustworthiness right off them. So it's important to, if you don't answer the question, at least acknowledge it or address it in some way, but don't pretend you didn't hear it. And over again, I hear people telling me stories about their media training experiences. I had an opportunity to work with a bunch of plant managers from a major consumer products company. These were folks who were running plants, and as part of our training, we were simulating disasters at the plant. What happens if, God forbid, there's an explosion and there's a loss of life? So we created a scenario where there's something bad happens and people have died. So I'm working with the manager, and I say to him in our simulation, two people are dead as a result of an explosion at your plant today. What's your comment, please? Well, we're very proud of our safety record. Excuse me? How can you say that? Well, I had media training once, and they told me to always come back to a positive message. So traditional media training is especially ineffective in situations where concern is high and trust is low. Trainers tell us never use negative words. I don't believe that. I think that sometimes we have to use negative words. Because if our objective when we're dealing with bad news situations and controversies is to come across as sincere, authentic, genuine, trustworthy, concerned, and so on, well, then we have to say what needs to be said. Now, I'm not saying go out there and, you know, just spill out those negative words. I'm going to give you what I feel are five criteria for using negative words. If you're in a situation where there is a very high level of concern, if you're in a situation where there is a very low level of trust, if you're in a situation where it's near impossible to carry on your day-to-day business affairs, if you're in a situation where they're talking about us in the state legislature or in Congress, or if you're in a situation where we're front page above the fold, yes, use those negative words. JetBlue, great example. Remember a couple of years ago they had this whole debacle when their system fell apart and folks were inconvenienced all over North America, couldn't fly out? Well, David Neeleman, at the time CEO of JetBlue, had this to say. Dear JetBlue customers, we are sorry and we are embarrassed, but most of all, we're deeply sorry. Last week was the worst operational week in JetBlue's 7-year history. Words cannot express how truly sorry we are for the anxiety, the frustration, and the inconvenience that you, your family, your friends, and colleagues experienced. We know we failed to deliver. You deserved a lot better from us last week, and we let you down. And JetBlue still lives. You see, I think that one of the most important places to start when we're dealing with a bad news situation is not to immediately default to the predictable, what are we going to say? What are we going to say? I think the place to start is to ask ourselves, what are we made of? And I write a lot about it in the book. I call it the value compass. The value compass is a tool that helps us identify what needs to be done and what needs to be said in a bad news situation. And so when we find ourselves mired in a crisis like this, we ask ourselves, what elements of our nature do we want to convey in our deeds and in our words? Do we want to show that we're caring, we're concerned, we're trustworthy? What standards do we aspire to that we want to make sure are reflected in our response? Do we want to demonstrate that we're ethical? Do we want to demonstrate that we're accountable? And in deciding and determining what your value compass says, you have to ask yourself as well, what are the emotions that the stakeholder is experiencing right now? Because it's not just about us. And that's one of our mistakes, about me, imposing a message, delivering my key message. So we ask ourselves, what are they feeling? What are the words? And then as we create and complete our value compass, we ask ourselves, what is it I can do and say that would enhance the well-being of the stakeholder in this terrible situation? And the beauty of it is that when we're mired in crisis, I suggest we take every answer we give, every message we deliver, every policy we explain, and we prism it through that value compass. It gives us a plan, it gives us a path, it gives us direction. And at the end of the day, if we do something bad, it doesn't mean that our stakeholders are going to love us. But sometimes a good objective is if they hate us just a little bit less, and we live to do business another day, then that's got to be the victory. Let me share with you now what I consider to be five most important tips to keep in mind while dealing with a media crisis, reflective of your value compass. Number one, be accessible. When a crisis strikes, reporters start looking for answers immediately. And if a spokesperson is not available to comment, other stakeholders are going to be, and what they'll say will no doubt be critical. I tell the story about a company called AlioSwiss in Kentucky. They had an explosion at their plant, resulted in the death of a 19-year-old man. As soon as it happened, the reporters heard about it on their police radios and ambulance radios. They converged on the scene, and the company made them wait 4 hours before it finally came out and delivered a statement. Because what the company thought was, well, you know, if we're not here, what are they going to report? Well, the reporters were interviewing the fire crews, the ambulance crews, the workers who were coming out of the plant because the place was closed. 4 hours later, a spokesman for the company finally comes out, and here's what he says, and this is brilliant. The only comment we have is that we have no comment. Have you ever heard anything so stupid in your life? So, of course, that's on the 6 o'clock news, and then they watch the 6 o'clock news and realize, holy cow, we blew it. So they perhaps look to their value compass the next day, if such a thing exists for them, and then they come out with a response that I'm sure was less than genuine and less than heartfelt, but what they succeeded in doing was elongating a news cycle on a bad news story. With the objective in a bad news story is get on the front page, take your hit, and with any luck tomorrow, it's on the bottom of a birdcage. Crisis tip number two, be among those most upset. Own it. By expressing true concern, it demonstrates our sincerity, it reflects a sense of accountability. Because when bad news happens, people don't care how much you know. They need to know how much you care. It's the morality play out there. And being among those most upset is not only providing it's genuine and sincere, it's not only the right thing to do, but from a selfish perspective, it helps your problem go away a lot quicker too. Number three, pay real close attention to social media. We're told by Blog Herald now that a blog is set up every second of every day. We talked about that person in their sweatpants right this minute. And in the few minutes it takes you to set up a free blogging account, anyone can become a reporter, a saboteur, a critic. Tip number five to keep in mind while dealing with a media crisis, know that fact will never win over emotion. Facts historically have been an important part of the messages we've shared with people when they're upset about the low-cost housing we want to put in their neighborhood, and we hit them with all kinds of facts about, well, you know, historically and traditionally, property values are... People, we don't want it here. And all the facts in the world are not going to convince people. We saw good evidence of this last week in the recent election. There are a number of jurisdictions here in the United States where governments have been performing, have been seeing results, have been seeing growth, have been seeing a rise in jobs. But all those facts in the world didn't do anything to help the incumbents because there was a groundswell of emotion. And if we're in a battle of fact versus emotion, emotion is always going to win in the court of public opinion. It's just the way it is, bigger than all of us. Now, in the court of law or in the regulatory field, fact, of course, will prevail. So one of the things we need to do is we need to manage expectations of our clients, who very often will say to us things like, well, you know, just tell them what the facts are. It ain't going to work. I'll tell you something funny fast. We give that course at Harvard Law School called Dealing with an Angry Public. We did it last week, and we had about half a dozen people from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission come. And one of the nuclear engineers stood up and said, well, the reason we're taking this course called Dealing with an Angry Public is we want to help our angry publics learn how to strip away emotion so they focus only on fact. And we had a good laugh. I heard a good line. I got to share it with you. I heard a good... It came from a nuclear engineer. How do you tell a nuclear engineer who's an extrovert from a nuclear engineer who's an introvert. Do you know how? The nuclear engineer who's the extrovert is looking at your shoes. Okay, I just love that one. I had to share it. Okay, media tip number 5 for dealing with a crisis. Couple concern with commitment to action. Because concern without action is meaningless yip-yap. So be certain that stakeholders are aware of the steps and actions you're taking to confront a crisis. Jamba Juice, California-based beverage company. They boast about the fact they have non-dairy in their products. Well, there's a blog called The Consumerist, and one day it tells the story of how Jamba Juice has dairy in its beverage products. Big problem. So what does the Jamba Juice do? They contact The Consumerist, and they say it's just not true. So The Consumerist fixes the blog, corrects it on its website. Meanwhile, 23 other blogs picked up the feed. And Jamba Juice, on their website, they didn't tell the story. So 23 times as many people read the bad information as the good information. So we got to be there to tell our story. You know, one company that brought this all to life is a meat processor here in North America called Maple Leaf Foods. They're real big. Maple Leaf Foods, about 2 years ago, had a problem in Canada. 22 Canadians died as a result of listeriosis. And so Maple Leaf Foods had to recall its products. It was real big. Not only did they have to recall from the supermarkets, but places like Subway Sandwich had to have signs in the window saying, "We don't serve Maple Leaf meat." I mean, this really trickled down. So the president of the company, a fellow named Michael McCain, got on TV with great regularity, got on the web with great regularity, and he said something that I thought was so right on. This guy really got it. McCain said, "At the height of this crisis, the last two people I'm taking advice from now are my lawyer and my accountant." Ah, that's beautiful. Right on. You see, very often when companies are in these terrible situations, there is an inbred reluctance to acknowledge the concerns of other people. Historically, what do? We knee-jerk to arguments. We refuse to acknowledge the concerns of angry or upset stakeholders. And more often than not, who's causing this? General counsel. Who's whispering in the CEO's ear, and the CEO places great credence in what she is told by general counsel. Because general counsel's job, of course, is to save us a boatload of dough in court. Without factoring in that oftentimes we may save $100 million in court and lose $500 million in sales. So who's the winner there? It's real important that there are strong public affairs people at the table to push back against general counsel. And I say this respectfully, and I'm generalizing. General counsel often thinks, "Well, you know, I make a living with my mouth. Just leave it to me. I know what I'm talking about." And they're the worst with media. They'll kill us. Give a lot of thought to not putting your lawyer or general counsel in front of the media. Because, and I say this, I'm generalizing, because I met some really good lawyers who get it. But oftentimes, when they were giving out empathy, the lawyers were hiding behind the door. Because when people are upset, they want two things. The second thing they want is fix my problem. The first thing they want is what? Pardon? An apology? Or even an acknowledgement. I think it's important to talk about apologies too. So I think we should talk about that in a moment or so, because there's such a fear of apologizing. But let me give you a good example of what I think is an acknowledgement of a problem. At the height of the crisis involving the Catholic Church, there's a parish priest in Boston. He's quite well known. His name is Father James Flavin. And Father Flavin told Newsweek magazine at the height of the scandal, and I'm going to quote now, "I wouldn't trust the priest right now either. The church screwed up royally." Right on. What he did was, he said what everybody knows to be true. But there is such a reluctance to acknowledge the obvious. Contrast that with what happened to the Catholic Church last week. I don't know if you read about it, but the Archbishop in Belgium was asked by a reporter, "Archbishop, do you think that AIDS is punishment for homosexuality?" And after everything that's been said, the Archbishop said, "Well, you know, homosexuality and AIDS is indeed inherent justice." And he went on to say that going after priests these days represents a kind of vengeance. Now, because the church doesn't really have in each nation a central organization, it's usually every parish for itself, the Vatican had to step in. And of course, what did the Vatican say? His comments were misinterpreted. Usually, the line of defense is that we were taken out of context. So how do we convince General Council of what we feel to be the right thing to do? I outline in the book a 10-step process. Let me boil it down to 5 steps for our purposes here today. How to get General Council to do what you think is right. Step number one, ideally if there's folks in the room, including the CEO and others, ask everyone in the room for words to describe how we want our stakeholders to see us and perceive us. In other words, our value compass. What words do we want to come across as authentic, honest, trustworthy, accountable, ethical? So establish that, make sure the lawyer buys into the words. And of course, get the lawyer to contribute words too. Number two, respectfully ask the lawyer, may we please try asking you these questions to see where your answers take us. Step three, and do this in a very respectful fashion. Step three, after the answers are given, ask the lawyer if her answers reflect the words in the value compass or the words we identified. If she says yes, but you don't agree, ask the group its opinion. If the answers do not reflect how the company wants to be perceived, step number four, ask the lawyer what could be said instead. And by this point, believe me, they're starting to see it, they're starting to get it. Step number five, steer discussion of the answers back to the original suggestion, adding words of value provided by the lawyer. And at the end of the process, have the lawyer see that they were the ones driving the process that brought us all to this very successful conclusion. Apologies. Historically, lawyers often counsel CEOs and companies about the hazards of apologizing. We have here in the United States 35 states that have what's called the Apology Act. Our friends in Canada have it in about 4 provinces. And what the Apology Act allows an organization to do is to say we apologize for what happened. And the apology will not be considered as an admission of liability in court. And I've got to tell you, it's real powerful. There's a company, for instance, called the Covenant Transportation Group. They're real big here in the United States. Every day, they've got 25,000 trucks on the road. And every day, their vehicles drive the equivalent of 1 million miles. And you got to know that the law of averages tells you terrible things are going to happen. Accidents involving families and school buses and so on. They have a new policy now. When something terrible takes place, the president of the company and one of their lawyers calls up the family of the person or people who died, and they say, this is who we are, and I just want to say how sorry we are at your loss, and we apologize for putting you through this terrible situation. And usually what happens, of course, is the family has their lawyer there, and the lawyer finds out it's the CEO of the company. Hang up. They're up to something. Hang up. Don't talk to them. And then the CEO says, look, do what you have to do. Sue us. Do whatever you have to do. This has nothing to do with it. Is there anything we can do in the meantime? Can we help with the mortgage payment? Is there a tuition payment you need? Is there anything we can do? And since they have done that, they have cut their claims costs by millions. They received a $1 million insurance premium rebate. And the settlements are coming in an awful lot less in terms of the amount of money. And a wide number of organizations have embraced this attitude. The Michigan Health System, for example, has had great success with this approach. And all it does really, it ain't Shakespeare here, folks. It's just a matter of asking yourself, in a terrible situation, what's the right thing to do? And in a situation like this, the right thing to do is speak from the heart. Be mindful of liability, yes, but of course, speak from the heart. Now, we want to be responsive as best we can to the media and to our other important stakeholders, but let me ask you this. Does that mean that we as companies and we as spokespeople have to answer every single question that a reporter asks? Let's play a game now. There's a company here in the United States. It's called Tim Hortons. Have you heard about it? They sell coffee, donuts, 500 stores here in the United States, about 3,000 stores in Canada. So they went into a tizzy because one day a woman named Carla Homolka, with her husband, murdered her sister and took two 14-year-old girls captive, tortured them, and videotaped it, and had killed them. So Homolka went to jail, but got a reduced sentence because she squealed on her husband. So here's where the tapes are. He did it all. So he's in jail for life. He'll never get out. She got out after about 10 years. So she's doing an interview on national TV the day of her release. And the reporter says to her, well, Ms. Homolka, now that you're free, what's the first thing you're going to do? So what does she say? I want to go to Tim Hortons for a Frappuccino. Okay, so Tim Hortons is now, oh my goodness, she talked about Tim Hortons. Well, I guess we have to say something to the media. So the reporters are calling up Tim Hortons, and Tim Hortons is trying to figure out what to say. So I want to ask you, take 60 seconds or less at your table. Imagine you're counseling Tim Hortons. What do you say to the media in response to the fact that Carla Homolka wants one of your Frappuccinos? Take a few seconds, please. Talk amongst yourselves. Okay, a couple more seconds, then we'll hear some answers. Okay, we're hearing some answers here, folks. Sir, yours?
Well, as a table, we feel that...
Nice and loud.
Yeah, we think it's great that that this person enjoys our Frappuccino, and,
Oh, that's plenty.
anyone who wants one can have one, and that's pretty much it.
Okay, so we think it's great. Anyone who wants one can have one. More, please. Come up with them. And we regret what? Okay, got it. Thank you. That is funny. Okay, give her coupons at Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah. No one can resist our coffee. Okay, folks, you have anything over here? Anything? Mike, you got something? Give us one nice and loud. Leslie? Thank her. Okay, so thank her for the recognition. Okay. Make no. So what do you say then? What are the actual words you use, Molly?
We officially have no comment.
Okay, we officially. Okay. Okay, one or two more? Any more?
We just said that, it's more or less, make a statement on the positive. You don't have to say anything.
So what, Lee?
You just say something like, have you tried one? I recommend it. They're great.
Okay. We've heard some interesting answers. And more? Have you tried one? It's great. Right. So the government deemed her a functioning citizen and saw fit to let her go. Right. Yeah. Okay. So just to recap, we think it's great. Let me just remind you of the context, okay? She murdered her sister. She's a despicable human being. And everybody's outraged that she got out of jail. Because what she did to those two girls, and she did just as much as her husband. It's just overwhelmingly sad. Okay, so anyone who wants one can have one. No one can resist our coffee. We don't condone what she did. It was horrible. Give her coupons to Dunkin' Donuts. We prefer her not to come here. I think we're kind of getting closer with that one, but still. Thank her. Have you tried one? It's great. And government deemed her a functioning citizen. I'm going to suggest the one that I'm leaning the closest to, and argue with me here, is we officially have no comment. But here's my concern. Who says no comment? Usually guilty people on 60 Minutes, you know, with a bead of sweat slowly pouring down their forehead on a full facial close-up. So we want to stay away from words like no comment. Let me share with you two things. Let me share with you what I think would have worked in this situation. There's nothing to be said. And that's it. There's nothing to be said. Let me share with you what Tim Hortons actually said, because boy, they were such a tizzy. Here's what they said. We know that customers can differentiate what Tim Hortons stands for as a good community company and that there's no association between us and her. Well, thank you for telling us that. God. So, I mean, on so many levels, that just doesn't work. But to have to tell us there's no association between us and her, okay, that's really day. Number two, don't use your company's name, for goodness sake. This ain't going to help us sell some product today, I don't think. Good news, use our name. Bad news, it's we, us, the company, or spread the blame, everybody in the business. Okay. Folks, by way of summary, one question I hear from folks oftentimes is, okay, so these things are good to hear, but when you're caught in the heat of the moment and that glare of the media spotlight is shining right in your face, how are you supposed to remember these things? It's not like a golf game, folks. It's real simple. I'm going to suggest two steps to follow when we're in the glare of the media spotlight or we're counseling our clients of how to respond when something bad happens. The first thing to do is, honest to goodness, breathe, because I guarantee you've stopped as a result of the release of stress-inducing hormones. The second thing is remember what you're made of. Like I said before, take every question you're asked, every message you deliver, every policy you announce and share, and filter it through that value compass. And if it's heartfelt and it genuinely means something to you, it gives you a plan, it gives you a path, and it gives you a direction. And above all, you can say to yourself, I think we're doing the right thing. My thanks to the Philadelphia chapter of PRSA for having me here today. I'm so grateful to you, and I wish you all the best. Thank you, folks. Book is called When the Headline Is You.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for coming
Thank
out
you.
Today.
Thanks
we
for
really
the
appreciate
invite.
Your time.
Thank you, Linda. I'm very grateful.
Today, if Jeff's book is available at the table in the back, and the title again is When the Headline Is You, An Insider's Guide to Handling the Media. I have to say it's fantastic. I was able to flip through it and read through it in advance of today, and Jeff just highlighted some of the great content that's in this book. So, our randomly selected winner, and I apologize if I'm going to destroy the company name, is Corey Fenwick, Benoni Associates.
Yeah. Corey, hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
We can take we can have a couple minutes for questions. I know we're right at the tail end. I know some people have to head out, so we'll take a few questions.
Question is what you would advise either Conan O'Brien or Jay Leno say, you know, during this whole debacle, you know, it's kind of come to a head just yesterday.
Yeah. You mean at the time it was unfolding?
Yeah.
Well, Conan didn't hold back. You know, I always lean towards wherever you can, try to demonstrate some degree of grace. I don't think we saw any from him, but I think that's what his audience expected. I mean, they wanted to have that angry response, you know, tinged with his angry humor. It was really embarrassing, though, for Jay Leno. I don't think he's ever going to recover from that. But there wasn't any grace in that situation. I'm sorry? Oh, when Conan was fired by NBC because they wanted to give Jay Leno back that Tonight Show slot.
What happened yesterday?
Oh, he went back on the air. He got his new TV show on TBS. Right, and of course the media telling the story are looking for, this not really a good and evil village idiot story, But the reporters having to instill controversy, will his show survive? I mean, the guy's not even out of the gate yet. Already we're asking if it's going to have any legs to it.
And then his first show already has better ratings than Letterman.
Right. Yeah. Please. Generally, if people come to me, it's because they want to hear what I have to say. I mean, look, you can lead a horse to water. You can make them do it. I've never been in a situation, though, where somebody is blatantly ignored. You try to steer people. I remember once a client came to me. They were closing a plant about 2 weeks before Christmas. And I thought, this is a terrible thing to do. How can you do that? And so I saw my mission. They were going to close the plant no matter what. So I saw my mission that day as, well, if I can help them, if I can convince them to keep it open a month or two after Christmas and let these poor folks at least have a Christmas, then I consider that to be a victory. But what I do is I often say, look, you have it your way. That's great. I just want you to know that if this story unfolds the way you want it to, this is the headline you're going to be looking at. And if you're okay with that headline, go for it. So we try to use our experience as former journalists to be able to say, this is the story they're going to write. You like it? And that's why every session I start always begins with the value compass. Because I get them to say out loud, we want to be authentic, trustworthy, honest, accountable, responsible. I get them to say that right away. It's on the record now. So later, if they try to be weasels about it, I'll say, well, does that match the value compass that I thought's important to you? So it calibrates real quickly. It's a good tool. Please. Who wouldn't tell me?
Yeah.
Well, I would engage over the phone anyway or in person, but do you want to try it out? Can we play it out live and see where it takes us? Do you want to be the reporter or do you want to be the company spokesperson?
Yeah.
Right. Got it. Got it. Okay, great. A couple of things. I like the way you say story written because it really is paint by numbers. I have my victim, I have my hero, I have my witness, I have my expert. Will you please be my village idiot? Is the purpose of this call. I remember once, I'll tell you very quickly a story, my nursing home story. I wanted to get into a nursing home where I knew people were having bed sores, call buttons weren't working, terrible things were happening. But I wanted to get in. I could have broken, and believe me, it would have been great visually, it would have been really dynamic, but I wanted to be invited in. People live there. So I told the administrator over the phone, I'm working on a series about nursing homes, and I'd sure love to spend some time in your home to see what life is like. You know, let's show the folks having lunch, show them knitting, playing bingo. Sure, come on in. So for the first 10 minutes of the interview, I'm asking, okay, what's life like, and what's the morning like? Oh, they do exercise and physio. And then once her guard is down, I'll say, why do they have bed sores? So I didn't lie to her. I dedicated 8 minutes to talking about bingo and physiotherapy, so you never really know what the story is. Let me give you a three-step process, okay? Step number one, if you're the last slot in the story, it means you're either going to be the villain or the village idiot. And the reason they waited to do you last is because there's less time for you to get an injunction against them. Or they usually wait till like Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock because they're going to break the story in Saturday's paper, front page above the fold. So step number one, and this may sound obvious, but please, be friendly. And I'll tell you why. If all you have is the person's voice over the phone, the reporter will listen to the tone in your voice and they will say, an agitated Ansel told the Inquirer that. Where'd they get that from? So they expect you to be antagonistic or defensive. So as part of step number one, be friendly. Put a lot of inflection into your voice because the human voice tends to constrict into a very narrow band when stressed. And we haven't got the visual, all we got is the vocal. So you got to really use your voice to convey that, I want to chat with you. Second step in the process is tell the reporter I'm just in the middle of something right now, even if you're playing solitaire. Because the reporter's expectation is, I'm in a hurry, I got to file a story. I used to, when I was on the reporter, I'd breathe heavy into the phone. It's 20 to 2. I got to go on the air with my story. I need you to, and of course they would get anxious on the other end. So build that buffer zone. happy to hear from him. He should tell you I'm just in the middle of something. Step number three, please tell me how we can be of service. We'll do our best to help. Listen to what the reporter says. Again, forgive me for this. In the book, there's a list of 10 questions to ask TV and radio reporters. There's a list of 10 questions to ask print reporters. Follow those three steps. But the bottom line is this. Don't say anything you don't want to see in the paper tomorrow. Even if they say to you, well, I'm writing a story about how your company's killing all the fish in the lake. Oh, we're not killing any fish. Tell me more about your story. Well, they already got their quote. They don't need to talk to you anymore. So be careful what you say in that introductory phone call. And remember, if you don't cooperate with an investigative reporter, they like it. And I'll tell you why. When I was a reporter, I could count on one hand over 20 years the number of times I had opportunity to eat lunch. If you're not going to talk to me, all I have to do is say, okay, that's great. Let's make a stop at your factory. I get out of the factory and I say, representatives of Acme Industries refuse to comment. Jeff Ansell, CBS News, Philadelphia. Let's go eat. I hope that answers it. Thank you very much, folks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, you can drop us a line at steve@professionalpodcasts.com. You can also call our comment line. It's 856-861-6146 in the U.S. and 44020-7193-6146 in the U.K. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I use the name Podcast Steve. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For everyone here at the program, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.